From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Earlier today, a superseding indictment was unsealed in federal court in the Southern District of Florida, charging Jose Padilla with providing and conspiring to provide material support to terrorists and conspiring to murder individuals who are overseas.
This is an indictment that was brought yesterday, or within the last several days, against Mr. Padilla, a man who's been held illegally for over 3 years by the United States government at the whim of the President of the United States, pursuant to no law whatsoever. This matter was on its way to the United States Supreme Court, and in order to avoid a hearing by the United States Supreme Court of the legality of the President's actions, this indictment, which goes back well over 10 or 11 years, has been brought at this time. It's a dodge.
The Justice Department files criminal charges against Jose Padilla with no mention of Al-Qaeda or the alleged plot to use a dirty bomb in the United States. Then a top-secret Downing Street memo allegedly reveals President Bush told British Prime Minister Tony Blair in 2004 he wanted to attack Al Jazeera's headquarters in Doha. We'll speak with the head of Al Jazeera's London bureau, Yusri Fuda.
This revelation, if it's true, I hope it's not, it would be outrageous. I certainly hope that this document doesn't exist, and if indeed it does exist, I certainly hope that President Bush was rather joking about it.
And yesterday on Democracy Now!, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Colonel Powell's chief of staff from 2002 to 2005, defended the U.S. role in Haiti during the overthrow of the democratically elected president Jean-Bertrand Aristide. We'll get response from Congressmember Maxine Waters. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department announced Tuesday criminal charges have been filed against Jose Padilla, the U.S. citizen who'd been held for over 3 years in solitary confinement on a military brig in South Carolina. Padilla was first detained in 2002 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport after returning from a trip to Pakistan. At the time, Attorney General John Ashcroft warned the government had, quote, disrupted an unfolding terrorist plot to attack the United States by exploding a radioactive dirty bomb. On Tuesday, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announced Padilla is being removed from military custody and charged with a series of crimes. The charges do not include the dirty bomb claim made at the time of Padilla's arrest. We'll have more on the charges in just a few minutes. A 24-year-old Arab American was convicted Tuesday of joining Al-Qaeda and plotting to assassinate President Bush. Houston native Ahmed Omar Abu Ali was tried after spending nearly 2 years in a Saudi Arabian prison where he says he was tortured into making a confession. Two doctors who examined him corroborated his claim. Abu Ali moved to Saudi Arabia to study Islam in the year 2000. He was arrested 3 years later while taking final exams at the Islamic University of Medina. He'll be sentenced on February 17th and faces life in prison. The British government has threatened to sue newspapers that publish contents of a leaked memo in which President Bush allegedly discusses bombing the Arabic satellite network Al Jazeera. The government says it would take action under the Official Secrets Act, which makes it illegal to come into possession of government information without lawful authority. The British newspaper Daily Mirror disclosed the memo Tuesday. The paper based its report on a confidential Downing Street memo that claimed Bush told British Prime Minister Tony Blair in April 2004 he wanted to attack Al Jazeera's headquarters in Qatar. Blair allegedly talked Bush out of the strike, fearing revenge attacks. The Daily Mirror says it'll comply with the government's threat against publication, but Daily Mirror editor Richard Wallace said, quote, "We made the government fully aware of the intention to publish and were given no comment officially or unofficially. Suddenly, 24 hours later, we're threatened under Section 5 of the Secrets Act." Two British civil servants have been charged in connection with the leak. We'll have more on this case in a few minutes. The Bush administration has announced it'll lift a 6-year arms embargo and resume full relations with the Indonesian military. The State Department said it'll provide aid to, quote, help modernize the Indonesian military, provide further incentives for reform of the Indonesian military, and support U.S. and Indonesian security objectives, including counterterrorism, maritime security, and disaster relief, unquote. Military ties with Indonesia were scaled back following the massacre of civilians in East Timor in 1991. Indonesian occupied East Timor for over a quarter of a century, where it was accused of killing more than a third of the population, 200,000 people. It also killed thousands in embattled Aceh province over the last decade. In a statement, the East Timor Action Network said, quote, U.S. support for an unreformed military which remains above the law is not in the interest of the United States or Indonesia. This is a profoundly disappointing and sad day for human rights protections everywhere, but especially in Indonesia, East Timor, and the U.S., the statement said. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the military says it's killed almost 60 rebels. The offensive took place in the northeastern Ituri region in a three-day raid backed by UN troops. The military says the rebels are part of the Ituri Patriotic Resistance Front, an armed group thought to have given up most of its weapons in a demobilization program earlier this year. A spokesperson for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said thousands of civilians have fled villages near the fighting. Since 1999, clashes between militias in the area have killed more than 50,000 and forced 500,000 people to flee their homes. In Iraq, a suicide bomber killed 21 people in the town of Kirkuk Tuesday. In Tikrit, mortar shelling disrupted a ceremony marking the transfer of one of Saddam Hussein's palaces from American to Iraqi control. The shell failed to explode, but forced U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad and military commander General George Casey to take cover inside the palace. Meanwhile, a senior Sunni leader is dead after gunmen wearing Iraqi army uniforms broke into his home and killed him. Khadim Sarid al-Hamayim was the leader of the Sunni Bata tribe and the brother of a parliamentary candidate in the December 15th election. Three of his brothers were also killed. Meanwhile, an advisor to the Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani, said a representative from an insurgent group had accepted a government offer to negotiate with those willing to lay down their arms. The advisor did not name the group. A new article by investigative journalist Murray Wass in the National Journal says President Bush was notified 10 days after the 9/11 attacks. U.S. intelligence had no evidence linking Iraq to al-Qaeda or the attacks. According to several current and former government officials, little evidence has emerged to contradict the assessment. One former high-level official said, quote, what the president was told on September 21, 2001 was consistent with everything he's been told since. The evidence just wasn't there, he said. The Bush administration has so far refused to release the briefing, not even as a redacted document. Administration officials subsequently ignored the intelligence assessments in favor of those that alleged Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons and ties to al-Qaeda. One of the key proponents of this theory was then Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith. In the margin of one of Feith's reports, Vice President Dick Cheney wrote, quote, this is very good indeed, encouraging, not like the crap we're all so used to getting out of the CIA, unquote. And that's some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department announced Tuesday criminal charges have been filed against Jose Padilla, the U.S. citizen who'd been held for over 3 years in solitary confinement on a military brig in South Carolina. Padilla was first detained in 2002 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport after a return from a trip to Pakistan. And at the time, Attorney General John Ashcroft warned the government had, quote, disrupted an unfolding terrorist plot to attack the United States by exploding a radioactive dirty bomb. President Bush declared he was an enemy combatant who could be jailed in solitary confinement indefinitely without charges, even though he was a U.S. citizen. The Bush administration didn't even let Padilla meet with an attorney for 2 years. On Tuesday, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announced Padilla is being removed from military custody and charged with a series of crimes.
Earlier today, a superseding indictment was unsealed in federal court in the Southern District of Florida, charging Jose Padilla with providing and conspiring to provide material support to terrorists and conspiring to murder individuals who are overseas. The indictment alleges that Padilla traveled overseas to train as a terrorist with the intention of fighting in violent jihad, a shorthand term to describe a radical Islamic fundamentalist ideology that advocates using physical force and violence to oppose governments, institutions, and individuals who do not share their view of Islam.
That was Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, but the indictment raises questions over why the Bush administration held Padilla as an enemy combatant for over 3 years. There's no mention in the indictment of Padilla's alleged plot to use a dirty bomb in the United States. There's also no mention that Padilla ever planned to stage any attacks inside the country. And there's no direct mention of al-Qaeda. Instead, the indictment lays out a case involving five men who helped raise money and recruit volunteers in the 90s to go overseas to countries including Chechnya, Bosnia, Somalia, and Kosovo. Padilla, in fact, appears to play a minor role in the conspiracy. He's accused of going to a jihad training camp in Afghanistan, but the indictment offers no evidence he ever engaged in terrorist activity. This is Padilla's attorney, Donna Newman.
We are fighting in our cert petition the government's position that they have unfettered discretion and authority to arrest any American citizen and label them an enemy combatant and detain them indefinitely until, at their discretion, they decide to do something else. We were anxious for an indictment because we knew that we could demonstrate that the government has exaggerated Mr. Padilla's involvement in any activity, that he was innocent of the charges.
That was Donna Newman, Jose Padilla's attorney. The Washington Post reports Padilla's indictment came days before the Bush administration was due to respond to his appeal to the Supreme Court over his lengthy detention. Legal experts have said the government's trying to avoid another potentially losing confrontation in the high court over its detention policies. Attorneys with the Justice Department have already filed paperwork arguing Padilla's Supreme Court challenge is now moot. Today, we're joined in our New York studio by one of Jose Padilla's attorneys, Andrew Patel, as well as Bill Goodman, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Andrew Patel, let's begin with you. What happens to the Supreme Court challenge over Padilla's detention?
The cert process continues. The government will file their our cert petition has been in. Their reply brief was due next week. They will get a short extension to file a brief. We anticipate that they will raise the issue of mootness, and we will reply that it is not moot, and we will ask the court to consider this very important issue. Not only is it not moot as to Mr. Padilla, for example, suppose he was acquitted of this charge, or the case was somehow dismissed, and the government decided that, well, we don't want him out, and they just declared him to be an enemy combatant and sent him back to the brig again. Until the Supreme Court rules that the president does not have that power, that's an authority, as Justice Jackson said in his dissent to Korematsu, that lies around like a loaded gun ready to be used or abused at any time.
Korematsu being the Japanese-American detained during World War II.
That's correct.
Can you outline what exactly this indictment says? It seems more to talk about the other men than it does your client. And his name is pronounced Jose Padilla?
That's what his mother tells me.
How much have you seen? Have you seen Jose Padilla?
Since we first got access to him, we've been able to see him pretty much as we needed to. Of course, we're in New York. He is in South Carolina, so there have been difficulties. But I've been able to see him every 5 or 6
weeks. And when did you get access to him?
The day the government's reply brief was due in the first cert round.
That's how long was that after his detention?
About 2 years.
He didn't have an attorney access for 2 years.
That's correct. When he was first brought to New York as a material witness, classic arrest based on a warrant issued by a judge, Donna Newman was assigned to represent him. When the president signed the order on June 9th, sending him to military custody, we were denied access. In fact, we couldn't even write to him. In the cert process, where the government asked the court to review the Second Circuit decision saying the president had no such authority, we asked the court to take the due process issue, including whether we could see Mr. Padilla, or more importantly, whether Mr. Padilla could see us. Their reply was due on a given date at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, according to the court's schedule. At 1 o'clock, I received a call from the military saying that we would be getting access. At 2 o'clock, the government had a press conference saying they were giving us access. And at 3 o'clock, they filed a brief saying to the court that the court didn't need to consider the due process issue. It was moot. And they actually cited to the web link to their press conference of an hour before.
Now, the indictment, what does it say?
The indictment basically charges material support and conspiring to support terrorism overseas. There's really nothing.
Terrorism where? in Padilla's case?
Overseas, not in the United States. And that is just a remarkable shift in the government's position. We've seen them shift positions about what he's alleged to have done before, but this is a rather remarkable departure.
And the whole issue of a dirty bomb, all the things that the former attorney general had laid out?
I believe Mr. Gonzalez said that was now irrelevant.
What has Padilla's detention been like on this brig?
It is... to talk about solitary confinement is only begins to... It's the tip of the iceberg. He has been detained in a modern facility in a unit that has 10 cells, five on each floor, each tier. The other nine cells in the unit that he's on are empty. He is entirely alone. He hears no sounds except the ventilation. He doesn't even have, except when food is brought to him, he has no human contact. He has primarily been monitored by cameras and electronically. Even when he's allowed out for recreation, he is in essentially a concrete box alone. So his contacts with other people of any kind has been limited to about 15 minutes a day.
Now that he's moved from military detention and now will be tried in a civilian court, has what he said in military interrogation, will that be usable?
When Jim Comey was the deputy attorney general, he acknowledged that any statements Mr. Padilla made while he was in custody were obtained in violation of his rights to counsel and that they could not be used in court.
We're talking to Andrew Patel, one of Jose Padilla's attorneys. Bill Goodman is with us, also legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Can you talk about the broader significance of this? Were you surprised by Alberto Gonzalez's news conference yesterday, the announcement of the transfer from military to civilian courts?
Well, I was stunned. It was here's a situation where really an opinion written by Judge Luttig of the Fourth Circuit, who, by the way, was one of the on the short list for a United States Supreme Court appointment, is really a paradigm. It's a model for the destruction of the institution of the separation of powers in the United States and to give the president wide, broad powers to detain anyone he wants without any process whatsoever. This opinion is what is at stake. This is what is on appeal to the United States Supreme Court. And I have no doubt that now that they have charged Mr. Padilla with these crimes, this stale conspiracy, really, in my opinion, they're going to move to dismiss the cert petition on the grounds that it's moot. In my judgment, that borders on abusive process by the Justice Department. What they are doing is manipulating the process in order to sustain an opinion that says the president can virtually shred the Constitution and manipulating the legal process in so doing and saying someone who had been held really in violation of constitutional principles because he was such a danger to the United States because of these allegations, now they're irrelevant. It's shocking. It's an outrage.
What does it mean for someone else, how they get categorized as an enemy combatant? And then does the whole process start again because the challenging of the detention as enemy combatant will no longer be in court?
What it means is that someone to whom this happens, someone else to whom this happens, will perhaps at some point be allowed access to an attorney, will raise the issue in the same way that Andy Patel has raised this on behalf of his client, and will be faced with the precedent of Judge Luttig's opinion in the Fourth Circuit as a huge obstacle to obtaining any due process whatsoever, and will then be forced to take it to the United States Supreme Court themselves someday if the court wants to accept the case. I really think the Justice Department was very fearful that in this instance the court was going to grant cert and undermine the position of the Fourth Circuit opinion.
I want to play an excerpt from the Supreme Court arguments in the case of Rumsfeld versus Padilla from April 2004. In the proceeding, the Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg questioned U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Paul Clement over the extent of presidential power during wartime and how it related to the Padilla case as well as to the use of torture.
If the law is what the executive says it is, if whatever is necessary and appropriate in the executive's judgment, that's the resolution you gave us that Congress passed, and it leaves it up to the executive, unchecked by the judiciary. So what is it that would be a check against torture?
Well, first of all, there are treaty obligations, but the primary check is that just as in every other war, if a U.S. military person commits a war crime by creating some atrocity on a harmless, you know, detained enemy combatant or a prisoner of war, that violates our own conception of what's a war crime, and we'll put that U.S. military officer on trial in a court-martial. So I think there are plenty of internal reasons.
Suppose the executive says mild torture, we think, will help get this information. It's not a soldier who does something against the code of military justice, but it's an executive command. Some systems do that to get information.
Well, our executive doesn't, and I think, I mean...
But what's constraining, that's the point, is it just up to the goodwill of the executive? Is there any judicial check?
Well, this is a situation where there is jurisdiction in the habeas courts. So if necessary, they remain open. But I think it's very important. I mean, the court in Ludecky against Watkins made clear that the fact that executive discretion in a war situation can be abused is not a good and sufficient reason for judicial micromanagement and overseeing of that authority. You have to recognize that in situations where there is a war, where the government is on a war footing, that there, you have to trust the executive.
Paul Clement, now Solicitor General, arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court. Andrew Patel, you were at the table representing Jose Padilla.
I was. I did not argue. The case was argued by Professor Jenny Martinez, who's been part of our defense team since the Second Circuit proceedings.
That night, there. This was April 2004.
Correct.
That night?
The Abu Ghraib story broke. I have to tell you, I have no reason to believe and every reason to believe that Mr. Clement, when he made those statements, knew nothing about what was about to hit the news, but it's quite a...
Bill Goodman, the significance of this questioning of Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Justice Ginsburg did an excellent job of exposing the dangers of unfettered, unsupervised executive power, and of course those dangers being ultimately torture and murder, and the fact that there are people within the administration willing to essentially be apologists for this kind of thing is very disturbing. Mr. Clement, as Annie Patel says, Mr. Clement may well not have known what was going on at Abu Ghraib, but still the principle remains, and the principle is that without any judicial oversight or judicial check, this is the kind of abuse that clearly can happen and so foreseeable, and obviously Justice Ginsburg recognized it.
We want to thank you both for being with us. I just want to wrap up with Andrew Patel, last comment, and what's the schedule of this court trial for your client, Jose Padilla?
First, we have to get him to Florida, get him arraigned, and I've been told that this trial is scheduled for September of 2006.
Is there any significance about it being a Florida grand jury, a federal grand jury there?
We just asked that he be brought out from behind the looking glass and be brought back into the criminal process.
Andrew Patel, one of Jose Padilla's attorneys, Bill Goodman, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. Nasrat Fateh Ali Khan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on close to 400 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, college and community stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're podcasting, video and audio podcasting, at democracynow.org. Tomorrow, our Thanksgiving special, we'll be speaking with Jane Goodall, the primatologist, about mindful eating, and also look at Native American tribes in the deep bayous of Louisiana. On Friday, a special on Yip Harburg, who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz. Right now, though, the British government has threatened to use the Official Secrets Act to sue newspapers that publish contents of a leaked memo in which President Bush allegedly discusses bombing the Arabic satellite network Al Jazeera. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror disclosed the memo Tuesday. The paper based its report on a confidential Downing Street memo that said Bush told British Prime Minister Tony Blair in April 2004 he wanted to attack Al Jazeera's headquarters in Doha, the capital of Qatar. Blair allegedly talked Bush out of the strike, fearing revenge attacks. The Daily Mirror says it'll comply with the government and not publish the memo. But Daily Mirror editor Richard Wallace said, quote, "We made the government fully aware of the intention to publish and were given no comment officially or unofficially. Suddenly, 24 hours later, we're threatened under Section 5 of the Secrets Act," he said. Under Section 5, it's illegal to come into possession of government information if it's disclosed without lawful authority. Two British civil servants have been charged in connection with the disclosure of the memo. Asked to comment on the memo, White House spokesperson Scott McClellan told the Associated Press, quote, "We're not interested in dignifying something so outlandish and conceivable with a response." Al Jazeera bureaus were hit by U.S. warplanes in April 2003 in Baghdad and November 2001 in Kabul, Afghanistan. Al Jazeera reporter Tariq Ayoub was killed in the Baghdad attack. The U.S. called both incidents accidental. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting a former senior U.S. intelligence official said the Bush administration saw Al Jazeera as such a problem that the CIA formulated plans to plant covert agents on its staff. The official said the plan was never approved. In a statement, Al Jazeera said, quote, "If the report is correct, then this would be both shocking and worrisome, not only to Al Jazeera, but to media organizations across the world. It would cast serious doubts in regard to the U.S. administration's version of previous incidents involving Al Jazeera's journalists and offices." We're joined on the telephone right now by the head of Al Jazeera's London bureau, Yusri Fuda, senior investigative reporter at Al Jazeera and the host of Top Secret, one of the network's most popular shows. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
What is your response to this report of the Downing Street memo?
Well, obviously, we haven't seen the document yet. There's still a case pending. You've just mentioned the latest episode of events. British media have been just gagged from reporting any further on this story. I'm still hoping, to tell you the truth, we've been, what now, nearly 48 hours since this revelation, and we haven't yet seen anybody hit the roof in the White House or down the street, stepping out and saying, no, it's not true, or if it's true that the president actually did not mean it. I'm still hoping in the bottom of my heart that this will happen.
You have been commenting for your network, Al Jazeera, on various talk shows since this was revealed yesterday. One of the people you were up against was arguing that it was right to attack Al Jazeera, saying it's state media.
Well, it's his opinion, and I wouldn't actually generalize that every American would like to murder journalists for reporting whatever they are reporting in. Even if I begin to agree or accept any allegation against Al Jazeera, which I totally refute, I certainly, no decent human being on earth would even begin to justify murdering journalists. And in the name of what? In the name of spreading freedom in our part of the world? I mean, you just can't argue that you are trying to defend everything that Western civilization stands for, that you are trying to spread freedom and democracy in the Middle East. But in the process, you are actually doing exactly the opposite. You cannot argue for both things at the same time.
We're also joined on the telephone by British journalist and filmmaker John Pilger, writes a column now for the New Statesman, used to be with the Daily Mirror. His latest film is called Stealing a Nation. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Your response to this Downing Street memo and the latest news, Washington Post, a senior diplomat said the Bush remark as recounted in the newspaper sounds like one of the president's one-liners that's meant as a joke, but the diplomat said it was foolish for someone to write it down, and now it will be a story for days. Two British civil servants now being indicted.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a one-liner. I just think they're minimizing, and I'm not at all surprised. I'm sure no one's surprised. I'm sure Al Jazeera isn't surprised. After all, as you pointed out earlier on, the Americans clearly targeted Al Jazeera in Kabul and in Baghdad, killing one Al Jazeera journalist. They've been threatening Al Jazeera. It's part of U.S. policy to target the media. During the attack on Serbia in 1999, they targeted the headquarters of Yugoslavic Broadcasting. The numbers of journalists who have been killed by American troops is higher than any time in the modern period. The media is terribly important to this whole disaster, and getting Al Jazeera, which has done an extraordinary job of bringing to millions of people who otherwise would not have been informed about their own part of the world, bringing to them facts and information, is very threatening to the United States under Bush.
This latest news also in the Washington Post piece, and I wanted to get both of your reactions to this, the idea that the U.S. government was so threatened by what Al Jazeera was doing, wanting to put in plants the CIA at Al Jazeera. Yusri Futa, your response.
I'm sorry, it's a very bad line.
I have to tell you, we've got one of your colleagues is speaking over us there. I can't hear very well. So there's a double line here.
I'm sorry. I was just asking. Let me put this question to Yusri Futa first, a senior investigative reporter at Al Jazeera. The latest news in the Washington Post of saying that a former U.S. intelligence official saying that it was clear the White House saw Al Jazeera as a problem, but that although the CIA's clandestine service came up with plans to counteract it, such as planting people on its staff, it never received permission to proceed. Your response to that, Yusri?
Well, I mean, any news organization is open to anybody to be planted into it. Our address is actually meant to be every news organization's address, and every news organization's process is just out there. So I wouldn't be surprised that indeed there are some people who might be working, whether paid or not paid, for this intelligence agency or the other. We are very transparent, and everybody knows this. I can hardly think of anyone who introduced themselves as a journalist or a researcher or somebody who's associated with a think tank requesting a visit to our headquarters in Doha, and we turn them down. We are open. People come and go. And how would you know that somebody is not actually working for the CIA or any other intelligence agency in the world? I don't think that this is the issue. The issue is the way some people, and I would stress this, that some people within the U.S. administration view the world. That kind of arrogant attitude towards the world that we don't even need to even begin to explain ourselves is just outrageous. And when you take people for granted, when you think that, taking an easy target like journalists, unarmed human beings, just for doing their job, just because they wanted to stay in the middle and not be with any side like the president of the most powerful nation on earth said at one point, you are either with us or against us. Hello, I'm a journalist. My job is all about being in the middle. So it's from that point of view, I just wonder, in light of what happened recently, I mean, this revelation about this document, how many people would have been recruited into the mindset of Al-Qaeda because of something like this? I'm talking about mainstream Arabs and Muslims and even decent human beings, wherever they come from, when they hear about something like this. So we've been hearing a lot about people in our part of the world, they hate America and Americans. Well, they might do this, but they used to hate Americans for what they do, not for what they are. Now, with something like this, I wouldn't be surprised that Americans will be hated for what they are.
Yusri Fuda, what would you say to those people now who have been charged, two British civil servants, for leaking this memo? And also, what would you say to the British government, which has threatened the use of the Official Secrets Act to sue newspapers that publish the contents of this leaked memo, apparently now the Daily Mirror complying? Do you think that a news organization, perhaps even your own, Al Jazeera, should defy this? And then I'll put the question to John Pilger.
Well, the signs are not very encouraging. Again, gagging. I understand from a legal point of view that there's a case going on, and we usually try and be a little bit more sensitive when there's a legal case taking place. So I would refrain from commenting on the civil servants because I might prejudice their case. But on the other hand, when you gag somebody, the story becomes sexier, and everybody develops even more interest into it. I have a personal experience with this myself, having interviewed a former MI5 officer who ran away and started talking about things, and British media were gagged. What happened? Because legally, he could speak to non-British media, and then British media would take the story on. So you're going around things again. I had a very hypocritical approach, and that's what happened. I interviewed the guy, and every single media outlet in this country quoted my interview with him. So I don't think that it's really the best policy, but at the same time, I have a little bit of understanding because of the legal case. The ball is in the White House court. The bottom line of the issue is in the White House. I urge the White House to come out and say this did not happen, and if it did happen, the president would rather joking about it.
John Pilger, your final response.
Well, it's just part of a pattern, isn't it? It's part of a pattern of the unfolding disaster that is the United States domination and imposition of its policies on the world. None of these are isolated incidents. Targeting journalists makes all sorts of sense because it's journalists, that is honest journalists, and especially the journalists like those on Al Jazeera who might be saying the sort of things the administration doesn't want to hear. These are a threat, and it's something that all honest people throughout the world, and especially in the United States, have to face. In the United States,
John, a quick question. Do you think that a newspaper should reveal this memo? Now, the British government has threatened any British newspaper for revealing it. There's also, of course, U.S. papers.
Yes. Yes, I do. It's too dangerous now. Dangerous farce called the War on Terror has got to such an extreme now that the freedom of speech that we do have left, the freedom of expression that we hang on to, we have to use.
Well, I thank you both for being with us. John Pilger, British journalist and filmmaker, and Yusri Fuda, senior investigative reporter at Al Jazeera. He hosts Top Secret Network's London Bureau Chief, co-author of Masterminds of Terror, The Truth Behind the Most Devastating Attack the World Has Ever Seen. And I encourage you to go to our website at democracynow.org for full hours with both Yusri Fuda when he was in Washington, when we had him in the Washington studio, and with John Pilger, the interview we did with him in person. We thank you both for being with us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we get response to the former chief of staff of the former Secretary of State, Colin Powell. Yesterday, he talked with Democracy Now! About Haiti. Today, we'll speak with Congressmember Maxine Waters about what he had to say. Stay with us.
Ablaze by Bookman, 100,000 slaves and those unafraid who heard through the wire. You inspired Denmark, Bessie, and Nat Turner. Countless rebellions with machetes and burners. Maroons armed in their own farms with a village on, chopping up arms the slave masters. And all sell out sounding alarms because they had to. Black Pearl, unfurl your flag of hope. Black Pearl, white fang still clutch your throat. Black Pearl, you inspired the world. Black Pearl, you're still a Black Pearl.
Sac Passé, welfare poets here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. On Tuesday on Democracy Now!, we interviewed Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He served as chief of staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. We had an hour-long conversation. We discussed the invasion of Iraq, pre-war intelligence, what he called the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal. And in the end of the conversation, we talked about Haiti. During his time as Powell's number two man in the State Department, the democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was ousted. On February 29, 2004, Aristide was flown out of Haiti on a U.S. government plane to the Central African Republic. I asked Colonel Wilkerson to describe what happened the day Aristide was forced out of his country.
But this was a situation fraught with all kinds of chaos. And Secretary Powell and the United States government and our ambassador in Haiti in particular did a marvelous job, I think, under the circumstances of preventing what could have been widespread bloodshed and getting Aristide out of the country. One testimony to that was the fact that even though on the surface we had had all these rancorous relations supposedly with France, much on the part of Secretary Rumsfeld's having stiffed the French on almost everything they wanted to do in the way of military liaison and so forth, the French were willing to come in and help us with the situation in Haiti and to provide troops for stabilizing that situation because they too understood how desperate the situation was. But so I disagree completely with the characterization that the Trans-Africa put on this situation.
Well, this all happened after the Aristides left. Why not bring in these forces before? We were only talking about a couple of hundred thugs that were moving in on the capital.
Aristide was the focal point. Aristide was the person who needed to be removed from Haiti, and even he understood that. In the conversation he had with our ambassador, he understood that. He knew that he was the lightning rod, and that if he didn't remove himself from the island, there was going to be a lot of bloodshed.
Well, of course, he would contest every
point. Of course he would.
I went to the Central African Republic, and he told the story of basically what he described as being forced out of Haiti at the time, that you had this small group. I mean, these were not a large number of people. Small group, known killers, people like Jodel Chamblain, who was found guilty of murder in absentia for the murder of the Justice Minister Guy Mallory in 1993, Antoine Ismery. These were people who were known. Certainly Colin Powell also knew them, had been back during the first coup, had been there negotiating with those involved with the coup. this was not the overall sentiment of the Haitian people. And he said it was the U.S. that pressed him to leave, that pushed him out, that put him onto this plane with a U.S. military and security. He had no idea where he was going until he was dumped in the Central African Republic.
I can't imagine a man like Aristide, whose will to power is excessive, even obsessive, saying anything differently. Colin Powell, as you said, did know the situation in Haiti, probably as well as anyone in America. Colin Powell made the decision based on our ambassador in Haiti's very clear presentation of the circumstances. And the president made the decision ultimately, and it was a good decision, and I would stand by that decision. Haiti is a situation that picks at all our hearts all the time. Haiti is right next to being a failed state. And because of its proximity to the United States, we know what that failure means. And Haiti is not apparently capable of coming out of that situation. It's a situation that, as I said, drags at all our hearts. But in this particular instance, I think a good decision was made, a decision that prevented further bloodshed that would have been widespread had it not been made.
Why say that the president, Aristide, had an obsessive had an obsession with power? This was a man who was the democratically elected president of Haiti, certainly got a higher percentage of the vote than President Bush got in this country.
And please don't refer to the percentage of vote as equatable to democracy, as equatable to the kinds of institutions we have reflecting democracy in America. Hitler was elected by popular vote.
That was Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He served as Colin Powell's chief of staff when he was Secretary of State. And it was interesting to end on this point of the comparison to Hitler. I just went to see a new documentary called Aristide and the Endless Revolution, a film by Nicolas Rossier. And he interviewed Gerard Latour II, the unelected prime minister of Haiti. And this is what he had to say.
To tell you the truth, for me, President Aristide is already the past. I don't want to return to that, but nevertheless, he still exercises some power over his partisans. And maybe he'll continue to exercise it, as Hitler still exercises influence over many extremists in the world today.
Du monde entier. Gerard Latour II, the unelected prime minister. Elections are supposed to be held December 27th. Brian Kincannon is with us from Boston. He's director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. And Congressmember Maxine Waters joins us online from California. Brian Kincannon, on the facts of what Colonel Wilkerson had to say.
Well, I think he did get some of it right. I think when he said that Colin Powell was working for reconciliation, I think at part-time that was right. On February 12th, Colin Powell actually said to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that, quote, the policy of this administration is not regime change. President Aristide is the elected president of Haiti. 5 days later, he said that we cannot buy into a proposition that would lead to the forcing out the elected president to be replaced by thugs who are inflicting terror on the Haitian people. Now, 11 days after that, on February 28th, all of a sudden, Secretary Powell, who had been talking about supporting democracy, all of a sudden he says it's time for Aristide to go. And Aristide was, in fact, bundled off on an airplane to the Central African Republic. Now, what happened in those 11 days between Colin Powell saying he respected democracy and President Aristide being pushed on the plane by the State Department? They didn't recount the votes. President Aristide wasn't unelected. The thugs did not stop their terrorizing of the Haitian population. What happened was that the hardliners in the administration decided to pull the trigger on Haiti's regime change. And this had been something they had been planning for several years. And when they decided it was time to pull the trigger, Secretary Powell obediently pulled the trigger.
Colonel Wilkerson made the point that Aristide was afraid at the time. And I raised the issue of Aristide's personal security provided by the Steele Foundation, San Francisco, and them telling us that they weren't allowed to send in the last reinforcements, not allowed by the U.S. government. What about the U.S. military in Haiti, Brian?
The U.S. military had come down. There were a whole contingent of Marines had come in a few days before that. It was after President Aristide had asked for mutual support to defend the democracy that was under siege. And instead of sending troops to help the democracy, the troops were sent to secure the U.S. embassy and to be there in case they were needed, not to preserve democracy, but to help usher democracy out. And in fact, when U.S. embassy personnel went to Aristide's house, and part of the reason why he probably was afraid, his house was guarded by former American soldiers. The U.S. embassy people went over with a contingent of 50 soldiers telling him he had to leave. And one of the reasons why he had to leave was because there was a rebellion that had taken over much of Haiti, again, by people trained and equipped by the U.S., who were killing police officers, who were killing innocent civilians, and were letting all the prisoners out. And so, of course, President Aristide was afraid under the situation. I think it's interesting that Colonel Wilkerson stressed the courage of the U.S. ambassador. It's hard to see where the courage is in going in with 50 soldiers to someone's residence that's guarded by more former American soldiers and telling him to leave.
We are also joined by Congressmember Maxine Waters. On March 1st, it was Monday morning after the February 29th that the Aristides were forced out of Haiti. You broke the story on Democracy Now! When you called to say you had just spoken to the Aristides in the Central African Republic. You were the one who said that President Aristide said that he was the victim of a modern kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. Now, Colonel Wilkerson says this isn't true. He changed his story. He wanted to go. Your response, Congressmember Waters?
Well, I think Brian Concannon, has given a correct version of it. Don't forget, the Congressional Black Caucus had been up to the White House and had asked the president to intervene to keep Jodel Chamblain and Guy Philippe and those thugs from moving in to kill Aristide. Don't forget, Aristide didn't have an army. He was dependent on the private protection from the Steel Corporation, and they were not about to engage in battle with any United States Marines. So he was left without any protection whatsoever. The United States could have easily put down and pushed back Guy Philippe and Chamblain and those guys. They told us that they were looking for a political solution, and they refused to intervene because they wanted Aristide to be at risk and at danger and to be able to force him out because he didn't have much choice. He didn't have any way of defending himself. So it was a coup d'etat, and it was a forcible removal of President Aristide. And let me just say, at that meeting that we had with President Bush, Colin Powell certainly was not in charge. Condoleezza Rice was in charge. As a matter of fact, Condoleezza Rice sat at the spot that the person who is going to be the facilitator for the president sat in that day at the table, and Colin Powell was sitting in at the end, kind of at the table. She took charge, and at the point that the chief of staff tried to keep the president out of the meeting, it was Condoleezza Rice who saw that we would have none of that, and she went and got the president. But the president said exactly what the policy was, that they would not intervene, that they were looking for a political solution. So the hardliners had decided that, in fact, they were going to have a regime change, and they facilitated the regime change in the way that they handled it.
I wanted to go to President Aristide's own words. I went on the plane that Congressmember Maxine Waters and the founder of TransAfrica, Randall Robinson, organized to go to the Central African Republic to return the Aristides to this hemisphere, and had a chance to ask Aristide himself about what he believed happened. This is just a clip on that plane back from the Central African Republic back to Jamaica, where he went to consider his next move.
No, I didn't resign. What some people call resignation is a new coup d'etat or a modern kidnapping.
That was Aristide on the plane saying, no, I did not resign, and that this was a coup. Were you surprised, Congressmember Walker, Congressmember Waters, about Wilkerson's, in hearing what Wilkerson had to say, and the comparison with Hitler?
Well, whenever someone uses that kind of comparison, you know, and uses it lightly, I don't pay much attention to that. I think that's what you resort to when you don't know what else to say, and when you are, you know, trying to support whatever position you have taken. No matter what he says, they were not truly engaged in Haiti. As a matter of fact, I believe that Colin Powell didn't pay a lot of attention to Haiti, that he, at the point that we talked about the possible undoing of the democracy, he knew that that would be wrong, and I think he said and felt the right thing at the time. But I think that it was way past Colin Powell for several reasons. Number one, in describing that meeting that I just described to you, it was obvious to me that Colin Powell was not truly in charge of that policy. Noriega was basically influencing...
Roger Noriega.
Noriega was basically influencing what was going on with that situation, and the hardliners believed him. And even prior, probably prior to Powell even knowing that a coup d'etat or regime change was truly in the works, the decision was made and it was done.
Congressmember Waters, I want to just end with Brian Kincannon on what's going to happen next. Elections put off three times, latest set for December 27th. Your prediction and the situation now.
My prediction is that you're not going to have a very good process. It's been a flawed process so far. The under the Constitution, the government had 90 days to run an election. If you count the current government as being legitimate, they had 90 days. We're now on to 21 months, and they still haven't had elections. What they're planning on doing now is saying we're going to have elections on December 27th, the first round, and by February 7th, we're going to count all the votes from the first election, decide about any problems with it, run a second election, count the votes from that, and inaugurate a new president all in 5 weeks, when in 21 months they haven't even been able to effectively register people. They haven't been able to get the ballots or the voting cards distributed. Obviously, this is a fiasco. What
we have many 5 seconds.
Many are concerned about this. This is going to be a justification for putting in anybody the United States wants.
We have to end it there. Brian Kincannon, Director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and Congressmember Maxine Waters speaking from California. That does it for the broadcast. Tomorrow, Jane Goodall on Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fogo Caduce, Aaron Mate, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Ruba Rich, and Maddie Harper. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.